I'm delighted to introduce our speaker for this year's Shimizu Lecture and to take the opportunity to thank the Shimizu Bank for its financial support for this lecture series and other things. Our speaker this evening is Professor Christian Jorges, who's currently Professor of Economic Law at the European University Institute in Florence. Professor Jorges commenced his legal studies in Germany, where he tells me, I have no authentication for this, where he had a brilliant early career, being the youngest ever referenda candidate in the Republic. That's the first state examination. Followed a few years later by a youthful appointment to a chair in Germany. He was part of, I've written, that influential group, i.e. my friends, of scholars in Bremen University, such as Günter Teubner, Karl-Heinz Lader, Gert Brückemeyer, with whom we've had special links over the years. But instead of following the traditional German academic career, Christian Jorges travelled widely, especially in the United States and the Netherlands, and of course has been attached to the European University Institute in Florence for many years in one capacity or another. This international dimension to his studies has enabled him to transcend the particular concerns of German legal scholarship and to incorporate into his work many currents of theory and different perspectives from around Europe and especially the United States. Out of his many publications, I would draw your attention to two works which I believe were seminal in the internationalization of legal scholarship. The first book is the fascinating volume of essays drawn from an extended conference. The essays are called, I think, Political Legal Theory and Critical Legal Studies. In this volume, Professor Jorges was able to play the moderator to a very lively group between the radical theorists, mostly legal theorists, from the United States and Germany. You know, this was the occasion when Habermas, Luhmann, Teubner, Preuss, and various German theorists met the gang of critical legal studies, Unger, Kennedy, and Coe. I've heard many stories about that conference. I wasn't invited. The Americans claimed to have sorted out the Germans. Don't know if you knew that. That the Germans hoped they'd been able to provide a little bit of intellectual sophistication to the Americans. What is true is that this book of essays about legal theory sold out immediately, which is not a common occurrence for works on legal theory. The second volume I draw your attention to is the pioneering study of franchising. What's so exciting about this volume, again a volume of essays which Christian put together with interesting writers, what's so exciting about it is it's not a collection of comparative law essays, but contains a much deeper probing of methods and theories for the examination of this novel form of commercial relation, the business format franchise, whilst at the same time it's rooted in many careful empirical studies of franchising as a commercial phenomenon. It remains, after many years, in my view, the best legal study of this type of hybrid business organisation. There are many other essays I might mention, always thought-provoking and subtle. There are essays, mostly in German, which might be described as considering the dark side of German legal theory. It's important for tonight's lecture, and generally to understanding Professor Jorges' work, it's important to grasp that, unlike in the United Kingdom, private law and commercial law have been in the forefront of arguments about political theory, about the meaning of democracy, and the proper relationship between the citizen and the state. Unlike our domestic debates about private law, which proceed upon an axis largely determined, I think, by distributive considerations, such as debates about the regulation of unfair contracts. In Germany, private law is seen to raise much deeper constitutional issues about the role of the state, the rights of the citizen, and so forth. This background helps to explain what were otherwise puzzling to an English observer earlier interventions by Professor Jorges in the discussions about European integration and the single market. He published two essays in German, Markt ohne Staat and Staats ohne Markt, which translated mean roughly the market without the state and states without the market. In these essays, he explores the puzzling political development that by creating a single market, the member states of the European Union had created a market without a supranational state, and, more interestingly, had left states without a market to regulate. And from his perspective, who regulates the market is a constitutional issue, and the link between the state and the market is a fundamental issue of politics, not just a technocratic matter. Those essays lead up, via many others, to an evolving perspective to tonight's lecture, which has the puzzling title of Disintegrative Effects of Legislative Harmonization in the European Union. Why is the title puzzling? I think it's because one of the central tenets of European studies has been that law has provided one of the crucial mechanisms of integration. Lawyers, and especially the European Court of Justice, are in the spotlight of the project for constructing a novel kind of supranational legal order. But the lecture title implies a disagreement with that orthodoxy. It suggests that harmonization of law in Europe has disintegrative effects. Though I suspect that the disintegrative effects that are to be described are largely to be found in the national legal orders and the constitutions of member states. Of course, this topic goes to the heart of the major question in Europe with respect to private and commercial law, economic law. Do we need or do we want a uniform or harmonized set of legal rules for regulating the market? I'm therefore delighted and intrigued with the lecture title. I'm delighted to introduce Professor Jorges with his lecture entitled Disintegrative Effects of Legislative Harmonization in the European Union. Thank you.
No, thank you very much for first the invitation as such. I didn't know about the formal environment of this. I was honored anyway by the institution, and now I'm flattered by you, Collins. I'm also a little intrigued by his way of making jokes with me. You never can be sure. I try an effort in harmonization now. So not disintegration, but harmonization. And that is that I will indeed not do without a couple of very abstract ideas at the beginning, but I will focus really on a case, a recent case, a famous case in Germany, hardly known in the UK, but this in itself is interesting enough. And this then will be the lecture in three parts and always in three steps, which I, as a good German, have to take, subdivide everything in three. The three steps at the beginning will deal with the perspectives of Europeanization of private law. And the three issues I will talk about are indeed why is this harmonization effort by legislation a disintegrative move, so to speak? Why, on the other hand, has it an innovative, interesting, normative potential? And third, about institutional implications. But the case will be a tiny little one, fantastic, for private lawyers, a bank guarantee by Herr Dietzinger in Bavaria, wonderful little case. I hope you don't know him, because I'm going to talk at some length about this little thing. Okay, let me start with my three general observations. They concern first an analytical observation, then my normative perspectives, and third, their institutional implications. The analytical observation is uncontroversial even, only we have to become aware of its importance for law. And the observation is, known to us all, it's only no new concept, and that is the multi-level governance approach to Europeanization. That is a phenomenon we are all aware of, that Europe is not just governed by one sovereign, but that we are governed by different centers of governance and networks of governance at different levels. And these governance activities are certainly very often adopted at European level, but they have to implement it at another level, and they change in their implementation and so on. The changes are very often in the perspective, especially of people who are reform-minded, quite welcome interventions. They often reflect a consensus among member states, at any rate in the field of private law. On the other hand, they exhibit disintegrative effects in our national legal systems, and this is simply so because Europe just does not have one coherent legal system. It has a level of European law, supranational law, which is incomprehensive, and legislative activities which originate there have their own logic, if one wants to attribute that quality to them. But the recognition of supremacy to these activities does by no means mean that they will be perceived at national level as a new constructive part to the national legal systems. On the contrary, especially German observers complain again and again and deplore that they observe disintegrative effects within the national legal system. Now, this is simply so far an analytical observation. It is an observation of some importance because the changes that go on through the activities at different levels, and especially through the type of activities taken, a type of interventions prepared at European level, are far-reaching. They are of what I would call a constitutional dimension, but this is already leading to the normative perspectives under which I tend to observe this. The second remark, I could rephrase the implications in a normative perspective in this way. Where critics of European interventions observe destructions of the unity, the systematic coherence of private law, and doctrinal irritants, as one famous former member of the London School of Economics has called it, the defenders of such interventions tend to praise their superior substantive rationality, the merits of the imposed changes, and most notably in our field of private law, progress in the field of consumer protection. Critical comments on the disintegrative effects of the Europeanization process often reflect, however, concerns about the normative coherence of law, which relate to its integrity and legitimacy. The European multi-level system has assigned competences to relatively autonomous sovereigns without entrusting anybody with what the Germans call a competence to resolve ensuing tensions. Small wonder, then, that our debates tend to oscillate between two opposing perspectives. One school of thought, particularly strong in Germany, would resolve the tension by favoring the supremacy of European law while at the same time restricting the contents of European law. This is famous and dear to all Germans, the private law society. Europe is a market order, and the law of Europe is the law of this a market society, and this has supremacy over national law. A complicated and interesting thought of a transnational economic constitution, so to speak. Anyway, this is the one side of the debate strong in Germany. The countervision defends, on the other hand, the autonomy of our inherited legal systems, not because of their doctrinal purity only, but in order to preserve the links of private law with national cultures, traditions, democratic institutions. The dichotomy between a supranational or transnational private law on the one hand and the pluralism of national laws on the other hand seems compelling and unproductive at the same time. we are all somehow ready to admit that we will have to live with both the emergence of supranational structures of governance and the continuous importance of national legal systems. Should this then be the challenge of Europeanization, that we have to organize the compatibility of different legal orders and stop to search for a new unity or to preserve the inherited one? We would have then to imagine a law of Europeanization organizing this compatibility. Third observation concerns institutional implications. We have a huge debate in Europe by now on, sad and unrealistic, but a real debate on whether we should have a European code. If my observations have any merits, their institutional implications are that this debate is useless. European legislative activities and also the jurisprudence of the ECJ are the cause of tensions between different sovereigns. They cannot be their cure. The short-term and long-term effect of European interventions are only partly foreseeable and require protective and flexible reactions again and again. And this is why the responses to the problem of Europeanization will depend on the innovative potential of practitioners and the creativity of the judiciary. In other words, I don't believe that anybody in Europe will be able to produce a code. Well, code can mean different things. A code French or German style, which would cover the whole of European private law. There is simply no sovereign who could do that. The supremacy of the ECJ, the European Court of Justice, then, can claim is selective and never comprehensive. So even the court rule will not produce this unity of private law in Europe. Responses to complex issues cannot be expected from rulings originating from above. They must be found in another way. My concept for this will be called interactive jurisprudence within the European judiciary. But this is now enough. I go to my example. What do all these abstract statements mean? My example is taken from a recent judgment of the European Court of Justice, Bayerische Hypotheken und Wechselbank against Edgar Dietzinger. This case has attracted an enormous attention, especially in Germany, virtually none in the UK. 42 notes and comments on this one case, 36 by German law professors, 6 by the rest of the world, none from the UK. But you should write one. It is an interesting case. Now, in my analysis, I will take up three issues, the three just outlined, and will first point to the analytical multi-level dimension of the legal framework, then point alternatively to supranational and national responses, and finally explain what it would mean to understand the history of this little case as an exercise in interactive European adjudication. The history of the case. In September 1992, Herr Edgar Dietzinger had signed a guarantee for his father's commitment out of an account overdraft facility to the Bayerische Hypotheken und Wechselbank, the bank. Some months later, the bank canceled Father Dietzinger's credit and turned to son Edgar. 100,000 marks were at issue. Edgar Dietzinger, however, pointed to the fact that he had signed the guarantee at his parents' home, his mother and his father being present. For that reason, so he argued, the bank should have respected Section 2.1.4 of the Haustür Widerrufsgesetz of 1986, which required to give consumers written notice of their right to cancel a guarantee within 1 week. Since the bank had not complied with that duty, Herr Dietzinger invoked the right to renounce his, what he called, a doorstep selling contract, the guarantee. Doorstep selling law is a newcomer to German law in 98, and the applicability of this Doorstep Selling Act of 1986 to guarantees was very controversial in 92 when he did this. Section 1 of the Act foresees protection for what the Germans call synallagmatic contracts. These are mutual gives and takes, we don't have consideration, but we have the Nalagma. And the Bürgschaft, as every law student in Germany learns in his first month, is a one-sided unilateral promise. So it's clear in the doctrinal perception of German law, the Doorstep-Sellings Act is not applicable. The bank won in the first instance in the regional court, no wonder. In the second instance, the higher regional court, Herr Dietzinger won. Then the case came to the Ninth Senate of the Federal High Court. This Senate had in earlier judgments already denied the applicability of the 1986 Act to guarantees, and it's important to note, I think, that even the Federal High Court made no mention whatsoever at that date, earlier date in European law. The 11th Senate of the Federal High Court, however, had indicated, another Senate of that court, had a contrary view, and this Senate had, for his own interpretation of the scope of the German Doorstep-Selling Act, invoked a European directive, namely the directive, directive of 85 to protect the consumer in respect of contracts negotiated away from business premises, Doorstep-Selling Directive. A piece of legislation which was uncontroversial in 1985 under Article 100 of the European Economic Treaty. The German directive, the German Act transposed that directive, and the potential importance of European law results from exactly that fact. The German legal system had already some lawyers found out about this applicability, and now the chance came up to say, well, shouldn't we interpret our terms in the Doorstep-Selling Act in the European way? At least the European court has supremacy in interpreting the concepts in this directive. Once this debate had started by a regional court in 92 especially, it could no longer be stopped. You may remember Goethe's famous apprentice who awakens some ghosts he never gets rid of. And this happened in that case. And the Federal High Court, therefore, felt obliged to turn to Luxembourg to ask about the scope of applicability of the German Doorstep-Selling Act. And this is a question the 11th Senate then referred to the European Court of Justice for preliminary ruling, where a contract of guarantee is concluded under German law between a bank, financial institution, and a natural person who is not acting in that connection in the course of his trade or profession, this was Herr Dietzinger, the son, in order to secure a claim by the financed institution, the bank, against the third party, the parents, in respect of a credit, is it covered by the words contracts under which a trader supplies goods or services to the consumer? These is a wording, a strange wording of the directive. I'll come back to that. Now, before turning to European law more closely, it is quite instructive to look to private law in general and to the assessment of the practices of banks who ask sons and daughters or husbands and wives to sign such guarantees. Is it really true that we don't appreciate the bank's behavior because they persuaded Edgar Dietzinger to sign a guarantee outside business premises? Should we argue that banks who succeed in exploiting children's indulgence towards their parents, should we argue that these banks are moving on the edges of the market? Guaranteeing a right of revocation in such situations simply defends, I would feel, the rationality of market actors against an emotion that is no longer controlled rationally. This aspect is not identical with consumer protection within the meaning of the European directive or the German Act, but it is exactly this type of assessment which underlies an important legal innovation triggered by nobody less than the German Federal Constitutional Court, and in the meantime, part of a well-established part of our jurisprudence in private law. This case law did not invoke analogies to consumer protection law, but it used as the only directly relevant norm our ordre public, paragraph 138 of the Civil Code, asserting that the law does not allow love and gratitude to be commercialized in the interest of third parties. The scope of protection thus provided is broader than that under the doorstep selling directive, and it is not restricted to specific localities. It is narrower in that this type of protection granted to family members is triggered only where they ruin themselves. Professor Collins and a student of mine, David Gary, at the European University Institute, have made me aware of similar interesting cases in this country. As early as 1974, the Court of Appeal in Lloyds Bank versus Bundy held, and it's important to cite him today, Lord Denning, that guarantees, a guarantee which a father had given to support his son with all of his property, was to be set aside since relationship as those between parents and children are likely to have been exploited unduly. Once one accepts that assessment, one should be ready to impose duties on banks and grant corresponding rights to their clients. Lord Denning's comprehensive evaluation of the facts and his resort to unequal bargaining power seemed to be very close to what the Germans do under their general clause in the Civil Code. I understand, however, that Denning's move has not been broadly accepted, but I read in more recent cases like Smith versus Bank of Scotland and others a convergence with continental concerns, even where they refrain from a full and direct control of the substance of a contract. Banks are required to advise a potential cautioner where personal relationships might disturb his or her perception of contractual commitments. Approaches converge, they don't become identical. Second step of the argument. My report on the state of German, English, and Scottish law now these days is, of course, a little simplistic, but it suffices to document that the practices of banks, about which Edgar Dietzinger complains, are in fact intensively discussed within our jurisdictions, within all our jurisdictions in Europe. I know of some Austrian law to the same effect, and I'm sure these cases exist elsewhere. It is also apparent that the legal innovation at European and national level, Doorstep Sellings Act, are dictated and motivated by different concerns. Clearly, the national approaches imply a much broader and more detailed comprehensive evaluation than is required by European consumer protection law. But how do these two approaches and the remedies they foresee interact? What nourishes the hope that the interpretation of the Doorstep Sellings Directive under the control of the European Court of Justice might contribute to the improvement of the law when it is already apparent that the European contribution is only so selective? It may be worth recalling that the involvement of the European Community and now Union in matters of consumer protection is not simply fortuitous. There is a clear European mandate to integrate markets. The logic of market integration does not restrict European law to creating and guaranteeing economic freedoms. The establishment and functioning of markets often requires positive regulatory action. Among these actions is our modest field of consumer protection. But should we assume that Europe's concern for its market citizens should extend to the type of ordre public or equity concerns issues we have identified, the Luxembourg judges did, of course, not address such queries directly. It seems, nevertheless, quite illuminating to bear them in mind when considering the alternatives which were presented to the European Court and the responses this court in Luxembourg gave. The alternatives with which the court became confronted, this is now a little technical, but it is interesting. These alternatives were methodological ones. They nevertheless, in methodological clothes, reproduced the two basic positions I have mentioned in my introductory remarks. The proponents of an expansive interpretation of European law favored a purpose-oriented interpretation. All our consumer protection friends do this, of course. And the reasonableness of the objectives pursued by the Doorstep Selling Directive is not can hardly be questioned. The contributors to that debate had little difficulties with favoring an application which would include the guarantees under German law and hence break with a many centuries old dogmatic construction. The most important proponent of the opposing view, that is, restrictive applicability, was Advocate General Francis Jacobs. He invoked the English wording of the directive, and that's another aspect of the case. The English wording says the contrary of the German wording, and there is a problem with defining the will of the legislator in any way. But that aside, he invoked the English wording of the directive. According to that wording, the directive shall apply to contracts under which a trader supplies goods and services to a consumer. Now, one can hardly say that making somebody sign a guarantee is to supply goods and services to him. So what is at stake in methodological terms? If we start with the objective of consumer protection, with the substance of this this intervention into the market, we would be ready to apply the directive. If we don't, if we restrict ourselves to the wording, to statutory interpretation in a more traditional sense, we would not. So the legal method issue was really broadly debated at the European level and motivated four governments to come up with their views on these issues. But was it really all there was at issue? I think the intensity of the debate reflects a couple of important economic concerns. The credit industry does not like to see the European Court taking a lead in the curtailment of practices at European level. So the methodological issue was important, but it was not the whole story. The deeper economic story is nowhere told in the judgment, and it's difficult to find anything out about it. The 36 comments in Germany I have read are not very instructive in that respect, but it may be simply the case that the banks don't like a court outside there intervening into something they are dealing with at national level. Here is my reconstruction of the alternative now the European Court was faced with. First, the European Court could have stated a new universal legal principle concerning the exploitation of personal commitments and hence define the preconditions of private autonomy on the European market. A bold step would that would have been, but such steps have been taken in other cases. Bosman, to my mind, is a hero in that respect. There are other heroes. In the case at hand, the European Court of Justice would have had, however, to justify this innovation through an extensive interpretation of a directive, a piece of legislation which is hardly a convincing basis for such a broad innovation. There is a difference between interpreting the treaty and interpreting a tiny little directive. Second alternative, the European Court could have restricted itself to interpreting the directive and base its decision on very pragmatic considerations. For instance, one could have asked, what will happen on the credit market if we curtail the legitimacy of these practices? What will banks do? To what kind of credit practices will they resort then? How will the costs of credit on the whole increase? Who will be protected? Who will pay? What will be the distributive effects among consumers and concerns of this? This type of consideration, however, is difficult for the European Court to undertake simply because this court is very far away from the actual happening to the actual conditions of market behavior and the like. Third alternative, the European Court could have followed Advocate General Jacobs and reduced simply the meaning of European law drastically. This would have certainly exposed the contents of European consumer protection law to harsh critique and implied a type of restriction this Luxembourg court usually is not ready to exercise. So the three alternatives I have: general principle, pragmatic interpretation of the directive, restrictive interpretation, are all the three difficult. And this is why the case really was difficult for the European Court of Justice. And only seen in this light will it become understandable why the court did something nobody seems can at first sight be happy with. This is what the court said. He said, yes, but, they said, it is apparent from the wording of Article 1 of the directive and from the nature of guarantees that the directive covers only guarantees ancillary to a contract where, in the context of a doorstep selling, a consumer assumes obligation towards a trader with a view to obtaining goods or services from him. The directive covers guarantees, the court explored, but only where the main debt, the parent's credit, is a business credit. Unfortunately enough, Herr Dietzinger, a consumer, Edgar Dietzinger's son, a consumer, remained without protection because his parents, Father Dietzinger, had this credit in the course of his business. Is this answer to be taken seriously? Most commentators in Germany ask and deny this question. The comments in Germany have been extremely critical, and indeed, once one approves an application of the doorstep selling directives to guarantees and hence respects the objective, the consumer protection objective of that directive, it does seem quite incoherent then to resort to the nature of the relationship between the parties to the credit contract. Why should Edgar Dietzinger be protected where his parents buy a newspaper at the door at home and not when they enter into such a business credit transaction? And Mr. Edgar Dietzinger's position seems to be the same. Indeed, it will remain difficult to find a conclusive answer to that question. And yet, before joining the critics, one should look at the practical options the ECJ has left open to the German courts. It is, of course, important to remember that the doorstep selling directive prescribes only a minimum standard of protection. The European Court was well aware of the controversy between the Senates of the German Federal High Court. The European Court was certainly also aware of the protection guarantees, of the protection of guarantors under Section 138 of the Civil Code in Germany. This is what I then would suggest as an interpretation. We, the European Court, realize that we have a limited mandate in the development of private law. In particular, we refrain from assessing the pros and cons of the type of protection provided for by the doorstep selling legislation as opposed to the more comprehensive individualized standard of Section 138 of the Code. We draw attention to the fact that European law has developed a standard of protection that German law has to respect, but that standard does not affect the situation arising here. It seems that national courts ought themselves to ensure the normative coherence of private law in their own systems. Is one then entitled to interpret the European Court's judgment as an invitation to the German courts to reshape German law themselves? In this very friendly interpretation, the Ninth Senate of the Federal Supreme Court would have had the chance to do what is right and just themselves, but they did not in a first judgment, it seems. The Senate confirmed for the area to which the Consumer Credit Act applies, first of all, that guarantors for standing in for commercial obligation are not protected. And in a second judgment, namely exactly in the Dietzinger case, the German court answered directly that it seemed appropriate not to apply the directive because Edgar Dietzinger's father simply was a businessman and not a consumer. So the German court literally followed what the European court has done and did not take the chance to interpret German law autonomously. And yet, the German court moved in another way. And not quite surprisingly, I feel. The the federal court, in reviewing the Dietzinger case, suddenly detected the general private law of Germany, namely section 138 of the code, and instructed the lower court to review the case again and to look into the case and see whether Edgar Dietzinger should not be protected under the general private law. So at the end of the story, we have not yet a solution, but we have options. And now we can reflect, of course, at length what is at issue here: German stubbornness rejecting a more enlightened European legal principle, or may the Germans have a point when resorting to their national legal system and require individual assessments? I should now, after this long and complicated story, go back to my initial general considerations. What does it mean to live in private law in Europe in a multi-level governance system? What is the perspective of Europeanization of private law? What is what does it mean to plead for a, first of all, judicial action as an institutional response to this kind of problem? But I do not do this at length now. I will be relatively brief and just note that years of litigation on Edgar Dietzinger's guarantee have not yet led to a definite outcome, but to an extremely complicated state of law. And of course, we have now to reflect on the complexities of this system of law Europe, the intervention of Europe, has contributed to create. But we should also be aware of the chances of this complexity. Let me repeat. We should note that it was a European intervention which has created doorstep sellings law and which had questioned Germany's doctrinal traditions and at the same time brought normative incoherences within German law to the fore. And we should add that a European quest for comparative interpretation of harmonized law will further the type of debate and improve the type of debate, rationalize the type of debate we used to have within Germany and outside Germany in these kind of matters. So the European role is not just creating complexity and confusion, but also forcing national legal systems to reconsider and to restructure and to create a type of normative coherence their systems did not have, although their doctrinal coherence may have been greater. Note also that the Germans did not just defend the dignity of their doctrinal traditions. They have redefined the issue of protection, and it is up to the German courts to convince the rest of Europe that their way of dealing with guarantees in a more comprehensive way under general private law is better than the European consumer protection approach. Not a bad rule either, the more so since one detects, once one starts to ask these questions, that indeed English law and Scottish law seem to move in the same direction. So, are we already arrived in the promised land of interactive adjudication? Hardly so, but a confirmation of my suggestion that the only institution with the potential to provide normative guidance for the Europeanization process is in the field of private law of the European judiciary. That contention I would confirm once more, and I would defend it relatively easy. We should not place our faith in comprehensive legislative solutions, not only because we know too much about the failures of codification with the national legal systems, but more importantly, because we would be unable, I repeat, to identify a legislator with the competence to unify the plurality of legal orders in the European system of governance. What I assume is that the European judiciary will engage in legal discourses which would be open to the claim of diverse social actors and cope sensitively with the plurality of legal traditions in Europe, and that exactly this complexity, this plurality, will further the cause of justice in Europe. Of course, a little brought a hope after review of such a small and complicated case, but the fun of European law is that even small cases create huge debates, and may even create good law. Thank you very much.
Time for a few questions. If anyone people would like to raise points or make comments, yes. There's a travelling mic which makes it possible for everyone to hear. Yeah. Thank you.
It's not necessarily a point on that you brought up in your lecture, but it's I think a point of general interest on European law. Subsidiary is a phrase which we've heard a good deal about, and it seems a very good idea, but it remains relatively hazy in its definition. I wonder if, one, it could be defined so that it could actually be applied within European law, and two, do you see the ECJ becoming sufficiently independent of mine to actually enforce subsidiarity if that's not what the Commission wanted it to do?
Yeah, I did not mention the term, and the term is loaded with hopes and critique and everything. In substance, however, I would say there is an exercise in subsidiarity here. If my interpretation of what the European Court did was to say, look, we have this case here at hand, we have the chance, we have now the power to tell these banks in Europe and the national legal systems what their guarantee law should look like, and then they said, no, we don't take only a very modest step. We only interpret the directive, which is a specific piece of legislation in one specific sense. And for the rest, we invite you down there in Germany, get it right. And we only point, and this is my interpretation, where I feel the European Court has done a very good job. It became apparent that German law is not good. It became apparent. And the German court did not admit that. They did not admit it, but they resorted to another device under Article 138 to resolve the case and instructed the next review instance to do that in that way. So on the whole, subsidiarity, yes, but a subsidiarity not just you do what you want, but a subsidiarity with instructions or advice or even prescriptions to a certain degree. So, yes, it can be practiced. It seems to me it gets a certain pattern. We have a certain pattern here which may make this concept of subsidiarity workable, so to speak. But this is my wishful interpretation.
Christiane, I wonder if we should be depressed about the story you told about the response of academic lawyers to the Dietzinger decision. 36 law professors in Germany are very excited by this. Nobody in this country cares about it. Does this not tell us that we should abandon hopes of a fertile interchange of juristic ideas via the European Court of Justice?
No. Not at all. First of all, my British student there in Florence, he will write something. But you see, it is also, the Germans should not be too proud. For many years, the Doorstep Selling Act was there and has been applied and interpreted. Only some clever lawyer detect, oh, I have a chance here to do something new. Once this was done, the thing exploded. And the principal importance came only after 6 years of adjudication of this act to the fore. So, okay, it happened in Germany. It could have happened anywhere. And now I have already detected the first comparative article on guarantees law between Scotland and Germany, a wonderful little article done under the Erasmus program in Edinburgh. A wonderful thing. So somehow, you see, it is Goethe's apprentice. And I still wonder what all these German professors do, 36, and six elsewhere, influenced probably by all this or had somehow heard of it. I think the case will sooner or later come up also in the UK. It's a matter of time until somebody finds out, oh, in that case, it would be easier to help my client with European law. There is a statute in the here in force which exactly transposes, literally, the Rostrup Select Directive. So it may happen. This is difficult to judge. It may be that the law is good enough and you don't need it. You don't need it to protect guarantors against such practices. Then it would, but I would not say that this is a case where one sees typically the benign neglect of the United Kingdom of European law. No, no. And the Germans also very funny. Hans Miklitz, you know him so well. He one of the very few people who are most cautious in the assessments of European court. All of the others just criticize and don't see what I have underlining all the time, namely the subtle dialogue between the European judiciary and the national court, which is a very complicated and delicate matter.
Thank you. I'm not sure I need this. There seems to be disintegration everywhere. The story which you told us about private law and the reaction of German lawyers to it could also be told in some form with regard to public law, because very similar arguments, it seems to me, are made by German public lawyers, for example, those interested in administrative law about the effects of European integration, the disintegration of the legal system, the weakening of the systemic features of the law. At the same time, there is also disintegration, it is argued, between public law and private law. The boundaries, the systemic boundaries between public law and private law are breaking down. And again, the European integration process, it is often argued, plays a role in that. Now, some use this as a positive development, talk about, you know, the mutual interpenetration and the capacity of private law to act as a supplement to public law and vice versa, and as I see it as a threat. What I wonder in all this disintegration is whether it is Europe, what role European integration, the European integration process really plays. Is it a real motor of change behind all this? Is it a catalyst for developments which we've already seen at the national level? In other words, is it really just bringing to the fore, catalyzing what has been happening at the national level for a long time? And some of your remarks would seem to point in this direction. Or does it, on occasions, European integration also help to reinforce national traditions of public law and of private law? I wonder whether, you know, you could expand on that a bit. What is really the European effect? Is it a motor effect, a catalytic effect, or perhaps in some respects a reinforcing of national traditions, at least in some of the European member states?
That is a wonderful question. You see, one trick I have done was to say, well, there are all these wonderful big problems, and here's my tiny little Ditzinger. And in my tiny little Ditzinger thing, I can detect all these issues you point to, but I need not generalize. I can at the end say, well, look at that story. And if I read it in a good mood, then come up with nice answers. I would, of course, underline that from the very beginning, when I say we have a multi-level system of governance, the whole of the interpretation, and this I did not expand, this I will do now, is indeed going in a certain direction where the most of the discourse on integration, disintegration, especially the German complaints about the disturbance of their doctrinal purity, law, and so on, is at stake and wrong and misplaced. What happens, and there Ditzinger is not such a good case because bank guarantees after all, but usually what happens is that one level of governance, take competition law, take banking law, where you have European law, foodstuffs law, whatever I know of, there you establish a certain regime, and that at national level implementation of this goes on and goes on and goes on with a certain diversity in Europe. And the art of governance is not now to impose a new Administrative Procedures Act onto the whole of Europe, or to identify, well, that is part of the business, but not the exciting business. What usually is studied is harmonization. To what degree do we get a harmonized body of private law in Europe? To what degree does our law of unfair contract terms converge? To what degree do we have common ideas about, say, the control of genetic engineering and so on? But the important message of the multi-level governance approach is be aware that you have to live with not just one sovereign, but with many. And no comprehensive competence, wonderful German word. competence, yeah, one Bindestrich. No one really able to govern the whole thing and to impose one unity or one doctrinal unity, one normative coherence on it. This is, so to speak, the real problem of how do you ensure then the compatibility, the productivity of this, what I would call competition, really, between legal orders. But they're not identical, they are complementary, and this is the Europeanization process, what I call disintegration and harmonization and disintegration is exactly the divergent or the creation of different centers of governance which need to cooperate. And then I have in the background of this system of thought, which is emerging slowly, but there is this idea of integration not through law, but integration through deliberation. That is, Europe has at least a chance that the conflicts or the divergence of opinions, or the divergence of interests pursued at these different levels, need to be argued out. There is no such thing as a command and control sovereign who can tell us how to do it. If these people interact, however, in a constructive way, they will find solution. This is why I say we need an interactive judiciary in Europe, not just the European Court with supremacy and the Germans complying. This is not the whole story. The story is much more that the different contributions at different levels need to create at the end a coherent solution, not necessarily unity, but a manageable way of problem solving perspectives. So my idea of the creative potential of the integration process is depending upon the readiness of these actors to accept that they are not alone in control. Not such a strange thought, after all. A risky business, certainly. But divergence, plurality, creates also problems of cooperation and chances of cooperation. I think I did not misinterpret your question. It's not a direct answer what is the case in public law or what is the case in private law, but a very general observation I want to make, that the multi-level thinking necessitates as a second step a thinking in types of networks in Europe, a thinking in terms of cooperative governance rather than hierarchical governance and these type of issues. And there is good research by political scientists saying, well, this is at least a problem. It is not the way it works necessarily, but at least this is a reality of modern systems in general. And we can even extend it beyond the European level.
The multi-level governance system that you sort of use by analogy to interactive judiciary has been critiqued as a sort of a garbage can model of government, that although it's sort of nice and decentered and pluralist, it allows for short time frames and unintended consequences with subversive frames emerge in ways that aren't necessarily desirable. It sort of is something that almost is sort of is pleasant because it exists outside spatial or temporal context, but when applied to them, quite nasty forms of hidden power emerge, which parties hadn't really thought through. Would that not be a problem with your model of interactive judiciary? Just because it causes us to reflect on unwise laws, it doesn't necessarily mean that doing it by crisis we project wise solutions.
That's, But you see, now, the first in German history, we know, you know, the Germany has always been governed by the Kurfürstensystem, La Fontaine in the Saarland and Biedenkopf in Saxony and so on. Nobody really governed that. They somehow, and the German federalist system, the German federalist system is the source of the theory in Germany among political scientists, especially Fritz Scharf and so on. And the message was more or less negative, these political scientists have. The famous article by Fritz Scharf was the joint decision trap. That is, you have all these people who somehow have a right to say, or a right at least to obstruct. This is the main main activity of politicians. They obstruct, and you don't get a problem-solving system. Yeah. In Europe, I say, oh, this is much better. We have better chances. This is easy to defend. First of all, the one difference we have is that, contrary to our established federations, fully-fledged federations like Germany and so on, you do not have in Europe such a powerful center in Brussels. They perceive themselves as very powerful, but they are more instigators, organizers. They need to persuade all the time other actors in the field. So contrary to a system like the Federal Republic, we have not a federation but multi-level governance in a different form. This does not answer the question whether this system of governance will manage. This doesn't answer the question. I can now simply resort to normative ideas, but the real problem is whether the constraints we have within these systems, the constraints, the needs to cooperate, the needs to resolve problems, are such that these problems will be dealt with and resolved. There can be no guarantee. I think the judiciary, with its special and specific virtues, I'm serious, with its specific virtues of arguing and reflecting upon cases and the merits of cases and contributing to solutions of cases, operates under principles and ideas which make it possible that an interaction will indeed produce an enlightened and improved production of legal arguments. I would call this sometimes a rationalization of legal arguments, sometimes simply the detection of incoherences and a readiness to listen. I don't read too many, it's too complicated for a continental, too many of these cases, but Lord Denning I have read, of course, and it is fantastic. You can persuade with these arguments anybody. This is possible in a legal world. I've done other studies. My favorites are these small committees at European level where people interact, and they interact under the rule of law somehow. There are a couple of principles they observe, there are constraints, there is law restraining the legitimacy of defining what is a legitimate argument and what is not. And there are certain conditions under which these type of multi-level governance systems operate. If they don't, we are all lost anyway. But it is certainly exactly the ambivalence of the present situation that we must admit that it is neither possible nor desirable to construct a unitary system of governance in Europe. So the network ideas and so on come to the fore, and the effort of political scientists, but also of lawyers, of course, should be to analyze the conditions of problem solving in such complicated under such complicated conditions. And this is the contribution of my Dietzinger. It's a little small one, but there I not exaggerating, but I see these elements, and I wonder, I mean, the European Court has learned a lesson in the recent years of becoming very, very cautious, maybe overly cautious sometimes, but also the national courts have learned to take European law into account and to something, and maybe this perspective is indeed not totally unrealistic. It is something which is emerging as I see it, and I would be ready to identify a couple of fields where these governance structures seem to be workable. Oh yeah, oh, you know him anyway.
Part of your argument against or for this interactive debate between courts is the unavailability of the European Code. And you said two or three times that this is a matter of, it's not simply that we don't want it, but it's not possible because there is no sovereign with competence to make this happen. Now, the concept of competence is a German concept. It's not very well understood here. And I would like you to comment what this actually means, because I think that there's an ambiguity here. There is a possibility that in the forthcoming IGC, the 15 member states come together and they add a new article, 100B, whatever. Of course, it's only renumbered. But a new article saying, as part of the internal market, the Commission can draft a proposal for a uniform commercial contract code. And this could be a treaty amendment. Now, with the institutional arrangement in place of direct effect and supremacy, I can't see any problems with this becoming the basis for a new code applied throughout Europe. You only need a treaty amendment. So the sovereign, if this is what competence means, is already there. It's just the 15 member states coming together, amending the treaty. Now, it's feasible technically. So is this what you mean, or do you mean that politically it's not possible because they don't want it? So I wonder if you'd clarify this.
This politically not possible, that one has many surprises. Sometimes things become possible which were unthinkable. And no, this would not be the argument. It's now very important not to, it's important to be careful with the idea of a code. Of course, when Orlando or you are talking about a code for contract law, this is not the type of code the Germans had in mind when they created the German Civil Code. The German Civil Code had the idea of really capturing the whole of the private law society in Germany and organizing it. This is the law of the land, and this is it and nothing else. In principle, of course, there was something around it, but this is unimportant, okay. Now, to say we create in a modern state one legislation capturing the whole of our commercial transactions, including all the regulatory stuff, is already very daring. To say this for Europe is indeed doing something which is unthinkable, I believe. And this now comes to competence. When I use the word, I'm not private lawyer, and we have our own terminology, but what I mean is that you do have, for the time, for the foreseeable future, fortunately for my life, different actors in the European system, and nobody being comprehensively competent to govern us. You will have, on the contrary, probably a functional differentiation. You have the central bank here, you have there's this one there, and so on. So what I want to say is that we will not create a system in Europe of law which is based upon or expresses the unity of one political body in the way Hobbes or somebody may have thought about it. We will live with different levels of governance and even observe now the emergence of the globalized law, if you think of WTO and so on. So when I say we have no competence or nobody to unify all this, I'm simply suggesting that political power, the governance in Europe and elsewhere will be pluralistic and divided and not easy to unify. The only chance is to search for compatibility and cooperation. In the technical sense of a code, you can of course codify doorstep Selling's law in Europe and then produce something. And even there, with my little example, you see all the interrelationships between, say, what European legislation has done was simply to construct a new right of revocation. You can cancel a contract if you have not been informed. What the courts in the United Kingdom and in Germany do when they assess guarantees is much more. They assess the merits, they assess the situation of a code, lots of ideas about the family and the ethics of the market, and all sorts of things come in. And to say a European code could, we can say European code can be the common reference point for this kind of thing, but even at this level of assessing complex transactions under normative perspectives, you cannot manage, I think, with the European code. You can imagine to agree upon a set of basic rights, a set of basic principles, universal legal principles. You can grant a Bosman the right to step out of certain contractual constraints, but you do not, by this very one step, arrive at a comprehensive regulation of the sports industry. This is just one step in a much complex, more complex process. And the same is true for guarantees. You can insert such a right, but the whole of private law cannot be unified through codification these days. And if one takes this task of courts to assess in the light of normative principles, factual matters, and to evaluate even the economic conditions and implications of their decisions to a certain degree, and to resort to take into consideration, as in the case with the guarantees, the exploitation of feelings of family members and husbands and wife situations. One runs in such complex issues. The husband-wife issue in the United Kingdom seems to me a little different from the situation in other parts, for legal reasons, for other reasons, social reasons. So to codify all this, codification should be modest and do basic things and insert a couple of good ideas, and for the rest leave it to processes. So I hope I have convinced you.
I've got two more people who want to speak, and I've got about 2 minutes, so perhaps we could do them fairly briefly. James, first.
Okay, I'll try to be as brief as possible. I just can't, I'm still trying to get a grip on this interactive jurisprudence, and I'm just wondering, it seems to me that in some sense it's empty. I mean, I understand the idea that the European court and its structure and it behind it cannot intervene to create a total code because its jurisdiction is not comprehensive. So that's clear. But whether it makes an analytic decision, a principled decision in which it sort of advances a new principle of consumer protection, or it takes a pragmatic approach where it, you know, assesses how the effects on the markets, or it takes a very restrictive, small reading of a directive, how is that not going to be interactive in the sense that whatever it says is going to have to in some way work its way through the law of the national system? And, I mean, do you see what I mean? Since they're not going to be able to intervene with the basic concepts which set up a national code or the national common law of a particular place, it's always going to be somehow at the edge, interacting with, irritating it, if you like. But I don't, so I guess what I'm asking is, how does this notion of interactive jurisprudence guide the court to acting in any particular way?
One of these questions. Yeah, but you see, the concept is stolen. Interactive is a strange thing. I have invented a term, deliberative supranationalism, which is an effort to do something, or as is a concept which tries to get rid of this idea of imposition of a supranational order on lower levels of governance. Deliberation is a quite well-defined term of interaction of a certain quality. Deliberation, however, presupposes an interactive process, and you don't see courts giving answers and receiving responses and so on. Courts act alone. They give a judgment and off goes the process and so on. I see, you see, when I look at this European court, they must have thought something. I mean, they have on this, and they must think a little about what will their brethren do down there. And and it is, of course, very difficult to predict how a court, independent and alone in the next instance, will act. But element of, say, we take this step, this gives you this and that freedom, then they observe what they do. The Dietzinger case will go again to the European Court. There is something going on. So my idea of interaction is, these courts try to define their claims and try to define, understand what a European court can do, should do, where they should stop, where a national court should look around in Europe, what have other courts done, and so on. Interaction in that sense is becoming aware that many, what all comparative lawyers have always known, that these problems are similar, and that one has to reflect as to the potential of legal arguments to get implanted into own legal system and so on. So it's not a very well elaborated concept, like you have picked, of course, a weak point. It is not like deliberation where you can say you have a sort of interaction going on which leads to a type of solution. It is an analogy to that concept among institutional actors, and to call this an ongoing interactive process is, however, not totally inadequate, because these people have to observe each other, and they can obstruct each other, but they can also develop perspectives of respect and cooperation. That seems to me possible.
I'd like to draw this formal part to a close and remark that there is a reception up on the fifth floor in the senior common room. You can take the lift. And finally, thank you once again, Christian, not only for the lecture, but for the subtle and thoughtful answers, I think, to our difficult questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.